My belief is it's like two wings of a bird, and one wing is the academics, but the other wing is the whole person education. It's the development or the unfoldment of potential. And so within that wing, you're looking at, well, how do I teach them maybe to increase awareness, to increase mindfulness, to work on things like emotional intelligence? So if you value those things as an educator as well, then meditation is a contemplative tool. If faculty want to say, how do I address the whole person and their potential, then I think meditation makes sense.
That was Steve Haberlin, and this is Mentally Flexible. Welcome to Mentally Flexible, where we have meaningful conversations to help you build mental flexibility. I'm Tom Parks. I'm a licensed psychotherapist, and in each episode, I'll be talking to people who inspire me most on topics related to psychology, mental health, and creativity. My hope is that through these conversations, you'll better understand yourself, others, and the world around you. Thanks for being here, and I hope you enjoy the podcast. My guest today is Steve Haberlin, PhD. Steve is a researcher and academic who has studied mindfulness and meditation in higher education settings for the past decade. As an assistant professor at the University of Central Florida, he currently researches meditation practices with undergraduates. Steve's most recent book is called Meditation in the College Classroom, which we discuss in this episode. Some of the topics we explore include how Steve first got into meditation and mindfulness, the benefits of meditation on unhelpful mind wandering, some nuances using meditation in a clinical setting, what led Steve to research meditation in the college classroom, the need for education systems to focus on the development of a whole person, and how teachers could start integrating meditation into their classroom. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Steve. I enjoyed this subject, and thanks to Miles Neal for connecting us. I appreciate all of you here listening to the show. Your continued support means a lot, and I'm wishing you all the best in this new year. I look forward to many more episodes to share with you. So let's get into this one we have right now with Steve Haberlin. Okay, well, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. Miles Neal had suggested contacting you when I was talking with him because he knows my work, and he's just a super guy. He's helped a lot.
Yeah, Miles is really cool. I love talking to him on that episode of the podcast a while back, but he's a really interesting guy.
Fascinating dude, yeah.
How do you know him?
So I took his he has a two-year contemplative study course. He started the online course during the pandemic, and so I just wanted to understand Tibetan Buddhism more for my work, so I took that course with him and then just started to, you know, email him and talk with him, and then he ended up writing the foreword for my first book. So, you know, I wouldn't say no well, but as a colleague, anytime I've asked him for something, he's just like, I'll help you. Yeah.
It's great.
He's just an amazing guy.
It's nice when people have that collaborative spirit.
Yep, he does.
Yeah. Would you want to maybe start by just introducing yourself, who you are, sure, what you do?
Sure. So I'm Steve Haberlin, and I'm currently an assistant professor at University of Central Florida in Orlando. I'm in the College of Community Innovation and Education, which houses about 12 different departments in the College of Ed. So I essentially, my main role for teaching wise is I work with doctoral students in the EDD program, so I teach research methods and things of that nature. But my research, my scholarship focuses on meditation and mindfulness in education settings, but my niche within that is looking at college students, particularly undergrad students, and how meditation interventions might impact them.
Oh, very cool. Yeah, and you wrote a book recently, right?
Yeah. The first book came out earlier this year. It's just Meditation in the College Classroom, a pedagogical tool to help students de-stress, focus, and connect. And it's just basically like a roadmap for faculty that want to facilitate meditation in the classroom. And we can go more into that, but there wasn't anything. There's one training called Kuru. They changed the name to Emerging Adults, but I think it's Kuru Mindfulness Certification. But there's really no books. There's really no hardly any literature on, okay, I want to put meditation in my classroom and see how that works as either, you know, a pedagogical tool, I help my students de-stress, but there was nothing, you know. So based on my experience and research, I ended up just, you know how they say, write the book that you wish, you know, was that you had, or the, you know, the book you want to read. That's essentially, I think, what happened was I was like, this will force me to learn more about it and kind of clarify my thinking on, like, how do you actually do this thing? How do you use it as a tool in the classroom?
That's really cool. Yeah. I've heard people say that before, but that's the first time I've really taken that in and thought about what it would mean to do that. So that's really cool. Yeah, and we can get into that
sure.
in more depth, but maybe you'll start. How did you get into meditation?
So my first experience with, I was always fascinated with Eastern culture and Asian culture. So, I just saw the TV commercial come out for Shogun. Did you ever remember that show? There was a novel called Shogun. And it was a guy, it's like an Englishman, I think, and he gets stranded in Japan during medieval times. So the reason I bring that up is I read that book and just got fascinated with Asian culture and the samurai and Bushido and those kind of things. And so I started reading a little bit about meditation, but my first experience was I was into martial arts. I did karate during the Mutant Ninja Teenage years and Karate Kid years, you know, in the 80s. So I was in the karate studio and we had this guy, and I always tell the story, he's kind of like a, he's really like a John, you know, from Cobra Kai. He's like a Johnny with the headband and the, you know, kind of chiseled look and serious guy. And he would have us kneel before class started. I was probably like 11 or 12 years old, and he would have us meditate. He said, we're going to meditate. And the form of meditation was we'd close our eyes, and he would just say, block everything out, you know, like concentrate and block everything out. And next door in the 80s was an aerobic studio. And so the music would be booming, you know, 80s music from the aerobic studio. And I just didn't get it. I didn't understand how you can block out the music and the wall vibrating. But that was my first experience. And I was like, what is that? You know, what I wanted to just, I think instinctively I was drawn to, I was like, what is that? Even though it didn't really work for me, I think, in the martial art classes. So then what happened was by early 20s, I think I was in the same situation as the undergrads that I try to help. It was like, I was stressed out trying to finish my bachelor's. I was thinking about going on and having to have a family and a house and getting married. And I think I just felt overwhelmed, you know, like be an emerging adult, right? Is that the literature today? So back then, even without social media and the pressures that these young people face, I think I just felt a lot of stress. So I heard, have you heard of Deepak Chopra? He's a big, right? So I heard the recording of him. He came out of the Transcendental Meditation Movement. He was kind of like a spokesperson, right? So he was talking about how when he might have been an emergency room doctor. He was a doctor, I think emergency room, and he was under a lot of stress. He used to smoke like a pack of cigarettes a day or something, and he said he took this Transcendental Meditation, TM, and like magically had stopped smoking, and his weight went down, his health improved, and I said, oh, what is this TM thing? So I opened up the Yellow Pages, and I found the nearest TM school was in Providence, Rhode Island. It was East Providence, Rhode Island, and I just went, and they have like a four-day you know, not workshop, but four consecutive classes or sessions is their training. And they prorate it. Back then for college students, you know, I didn't have the money, they would prorate it and they would give you like a discounted thing for college students to learn. And I learned and I stayed with the association as far as just like, you know, I went to some of their meetups and a retreat, and I just, it really helped me. I mean, my stress went down. People described me as a very type, like intense or type A kind of teenager. And then, you know, I was just calmer and more focused. I think a little more at peace with myself, because TM is where you, for listeners that don't know, it's a mantra meditation. So you take a sound, they give you this secret, they say it's a secret, you know, don't tell anybody, syllable, and you just twice a day for about 15, 20 minutes a day, you repeat the sound. And that what it does is it focuses your mind in a subtle way, and it brings you to to just kind of subtly see your thoughts and your feelings and your mind. And it's almost like a dive, like you take like a deep dive into the mind and the consciousness just within 10, 15 minutes. And what happens to the body is the body gets this deep state of rest. The nervous system just regulates and get a deep sense of rest. The researcher Herbert Benson, he studied back in the 60s and 70s, he called it a relaxation response. Basically, it's the opposite of the stress response, and your body is just kicking into this rest and digest. And if you think about that even once a day, but they say in TM they prescribe twice a day, you know, you're training your nervous system, you're giving it a chance to just settle, right, and to get some rest and just relax a little bit, and your mind also, right, to stop that. You're interrupting that constant thinking process or stream of thought. You're interrupting it through the mantra. And so, you know, it can help. So
that's really cool.
First technique I learned. And then I went on to, like, I joined a Zen Buddhist group and learned, you know, and I got into mindfulness meditation. And I just wanted to expand my repertoire on tools. I just felt like that was after about 20 years, though. I mean, I did TM for probably 20 years before I said, okay, now it's time to expand the toolbox. I know there's other techniques out there.
Very cool. Yeah, maybe for the listeners, a lot of listeners are in the ACT community, acceptance and commitment therapy. I don't know if you know anything about
that. I've heard some, but a little bit.
It's like maybe to make that ACT congruent around like that relaxation response. Mm-hmm. It's in that form of meditation. It's not you're not in meditation trying to relax. It's something that arises when you put yourself in a particular state. Because a lot of times clinically we run into problems when we're doing mindfulness or meditation with this covert agenda to feel better. And then that actually makes things worse. So, but yeah, I totally have experiences like that too. Not with TM, but even I love going to like sound meditation experiences. And there's this way that focusing on the sound in the room then is this vehicle into this other state of consciousness where you feel more relaxed and in tune with everything that you're feeling.
Yeah, that's a great phrase or term. It's a vehicle, right? It's a tool. It's a vehicle that brings you to just like a deeper state or a more restful, what they, in TM they'll call it like a restful awareness or restful alertness state.
Yes.
Yeah, but they find like you said, it's sound, listening to sound. They say, Benson found like rhythmic movements, working, watching the breath, counting the breath, like it. The mantra is one vehicle, but it seems to be the similar principle of where you just get in a relaxed state, close your eyes, and then you use some kind of repetition or rhythm,
yes,
and right, and in kind of like an easy way, and it seems to trigger just a more relaxed nervous system or more of like a regulated state.
Yeah, and there's so many different ways people do that. Like people can just use beads in their fingers and the repetition of that, or a mantra, or an external sound. Or even sometimes when I'm trying to focus, I'll play an instrumental song just on repeat, and there's this kind of rhythmic nature of the same song over and over again that's helpful. But yeah, anyway, I guess building on that, what are some of the things we know about the benefits of meditation? Like what does some of the research say?
Yeah, so the research has really exploded. I'd say in the last 10, 20 years, the interest in meditation has really exploded. You can kind of like divide it up into physiological, you know, you can kind of separate it out. I mean, in general, one of the biggest things like with mindfulness meditation research is it reduces mind wandering. And, you know, in this day and age where we use the term hijack, they're capturing our awareness, our attention through social media and other things. Mind wandering is just it's kind of natural tendency to go off, right, and just be ruminating or going to thinking of other things. You're not focused on the task that you're doing. So they find that it can reduce mind wandering. Just simple, you know, sitting for 10, 15 minutes a day and watching your breath, just following the breath, that makes sense, right? Because it's almost like if you were sat and you, I don't know, lifted a weight, right? You did a bicep curl or something and worked on that, that would strengthen the bicep. Well, if you're just sitting and you're working on attention in an intentional way, you're working on awareness and attention and just kind of focusing it, then it seems to strengthen the parts of the brain and the prefrontal cortex, everything that regulates attention. It just seems to strengthen that. You just get better at that, I guess, for lack of a better word. Yeah. So mind wandering would be one. Reduce stress and anxiety. Looking across different populations, college students, but also just general population, older students, prisoners, even children to some extent, you know, just reducing stress, reducing anxiety, depression in some studies, in some cases depression has decreased. Overall feelings of well-being seem to, you know, you just feel better, you're less stressed, right? So you feel better just about your life. Also physiologically, physically, you know, you can see some things pretty quickly, like reduced blood pressure, heart rate goes down, immune system seems to strengthen, to be a little stronger, balance in some cases might improve. So, you know, just, I guess you'd say like optimal, you know, you're kind of functioning in maybe a more optimal way because the stress is down and the focus, the clarity of the mind improves. So maybe your overall functioning is just a bit better. The tricky thing in describing the empirical benefits is it's not everybody responds the same way. So you could do a meditation and most of the group might experience certain benefits, and then for some reason someone doesn't, or maybe the benefits don't unfold at the same rate or time because people, you know, their dispositions or their health, their age. So I think we're looking more into like why do certain people experience benefits versus others maybe not so much. I don't think there's much research behind that, but these are just, I'm just talking in general, these are the benefits.
I mean, it's so clear as a clinician, just each client, you can teach mindfulness, meditation, awareness building, and each person's depending on the context of their life and their prior experience and how much they buy into the benefits. Right. Everyone's going to have their own unique journey. But yeah, the first thing you said around mind wandering and seeing attention as a almost like a muscle is just so huge, because if you take that intentional time where you make a choice to have your attention focus beyond your breath, and then you just notice, catch it when it leaves and return it back. Yeah, I almost visualize that as a bicep curl. You're strengthening that muscle. And then that's the same process that we're trying to tap into when your desired focus is on the conversation you're having. And then you notice when your mind drifts away and able to pull it back, or when you want to be working on some project and you notice when your mind drifts over to your phone and you catch it. It's like going to the gym in this really intentional way to use that strength in other parts of your life.
Sure. And if you think about that, if we consider that maybe an ability or a skill, like that skill is needed more than ever in society. That's only going to be needed, you know, that skill is just going to be required more and more of people in general, you know, younger generations, just the ability, like you just said, to be able to have all this stimulus going on, all this data information coming at us and be able to hone in, or selective attention, you know, those skills are just paramount. The other thing I didn't think of what benefits, I was listening to Richard Davison and Daniel Goleman had done a video a little while, Goleman of the Emotional Intelligence book and theory. So they were talking about regular mindfulness meditation practice also seems to link the prefrontal cortex with the amygdala. It helps you regulate. So in other words, when something happens stressful, we have like this unconscious reaction, right? It's like a knee-jerk reaction, but it seems to strengthen your ability to have like cognitive control. So you're more aware of like, oh, I'm blowing my top, or I'm going off the handle, or whatever phrase we use, right? I'm stressed out. And you become more aware of that, so you have a little bit more space or gap to say, okay, let me step back and take a breath. It's not that you won't ever get triggered or stressed out. I think it's just that you have a little bit more space or time or awareness to maybe have a more positive response.
Right?
And that's totally a big, to me, that's a game changer too in life. I mean, just to have that ability.
For sure. I mean, I forget who I heard describe it this way. I think it was, his name's the guy who founded Somatic Experiencing, but yeah, he kind of simplified one lens at looking at healing through trauma is taking all of those automatic responses that come from the amygdala and bringing in the awareness to kind of move it into the prefrontal cortex. And that's what you're describing can happen in intentional meditation.
Right. And if you think about it, if you have that, if you don't go blow your top or go off the handle, as let's say that happens to you 3, 4, 5 times a day, maybe, and then you reduce that, right, or once, or maybe that doesn't happen for a couple of days, that's like, you know, for the physical health, for your physiology, that's very healthy, but also just your relationships and
yes,
right, and how you approach your life and your goals, like that to me is that's huge that you, you know, have some control over like that strong emotion of whatever is coming up, like anger or jealousy or,
oh yeah,
or fear.
Yeah, even just one pivot makes a difference, mm-hmm. 1 degree difference. Why do you think it seems pretty clear that meditation is beneficial and the access to learning about it through apps, waking up, Headspace, yeah. Calm, access is there, but it's still pretty low, right? I think we were talking prior that the research shows it's a pretty small percentage of people that actually practice. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, depending on the source you look at, it's about like maybe, it's probably about 10% of the population that regularly meditates. That's like consistent meditation. And it seemed to go up at the pandemic. Like, I think the stress of life, like, and also, like you just said, there's just like, there's a plethora. There's so many more online resources and ways to learn it and apps. And but it's only like, maybe I've seen as high as 12 or 14%. And when you look at that relatively, like, that's not, right, you know, it's a good thing for you, but that's not a really high percentage of the population. There's some research on the barriers to meditation. The biggest one is time. So I think it's a matter of commitment. It's very similar, I think, to somebody maybe says, I don't have time. They know exercise is good for them. Whether they read the research or just common sense, they know that, right, physical exercise is good. But they might not go to the gym, or they might not walk around the neighborhood. It's because it requires a commitment, and in your mind, you're like, well, I don't have time. I've got a million things, so I'm not prioritizing that. Whereas I think meditators probably prioritize, like they probably say, if I do this first, if I take time to invest in myself first, and I do this practice, and I calm the mind, I center the mind and the body, then maybe I will be less stressed and calmer and a little more efficient the rest of the day. So they look at it as this is a priority, or this is something I'm investing in myself, and this is going to pay back later. Whereas maybe other people are like, this, I'm just sitting here, I'm not doing anything, I'm not getting anything done, it's a waste of time. You know, I think it's a matter of perception. And then maybe if people get into a certain meditation methods, if they haven't learned, maybe if they haven't had the right teacher or they learned the right method or something, maybe they don't see results and don't stick with it. I can tell you a quick story. I brought my mom to the TM Center when I was learning and I started experience benefits. And my mom had a lot of stress at work and stuff. And so she went to the 4-day and she learned the technique. And then she started doing it. But I noticed like as soon as she said, oh, I went on vacation, so I didn't do it anymore. I didn't need it. And then when she started feeling less stressed, she stopped. So it's almost like you go, oh, I go to the gym, right, and I'm getting toned, I'm getting stronger or whatever, right? I have more energy, so I don't need to exercise anymore. And then they stop. So maybe sometimes that's it. They don't feel like, you know, I'm not stressed right now. But the whole idea is to get the maximum benefit is just have a consistent practice.
Yeah.
Before you get stressed, you should be meditating as a sort of buffer maybe.
Yeah, and perhaps I know personally that I'm most consistent with it when I allow myself to settle into the appreciation of meditating just because I appreciate meditating and not having strings attached on how it's going to improve my life outside of there. Like you can kind of know that intellectually and maybe that's part of the motivation.
Right.
But if that's like a huge part of what's driving you to do it, there's kind of this kind of weird transactional process that we go through.
Right. And I like the term they're using in the literature, some medical research using like the word, it's a health behavior. So they're putting it, meditation as a health behavior, right? Meaning it has a condition, it either contributes positively to your health condition or negatively. So, you know, we've evolved to do certain things like exercise, even brush our teeth is a like a health behavior habit. And so I think the mindset or the culture has to shift to, this is a health behavior that we just work in, just like brushing our teeth every day.
Yeah.
You get up, right? You don't go, oh, that's a waste of time. You just almost unconsciously, you just brush your teeth because you know somewhere in your belief system, this is a good health behavior. So maybe if we could get to the point at some point where it's like even 10 minutes or 15 minutes, this is a health behavior. This is something I just work into my lifestyle because I know in some way, whether I can't see it right in front of me every day, it's helping, you know, it's benefiting.
Yes, totally. Yeah. And part of the reason why I don't necessarily teach meditation, especially early on in treatment, is because just workability around that coming into people's lives. And I find that there are ways to tap into the underlying process that we're trying to do in meditation of really being present and aware with what's here right now without judgment that you can do in these sort of micro exercises. Like there's so many little ways to build that in moments of your life that are maybe more accessible than somebody getting over the hump of feeling motivated to sit down for 10 or 15 right. minutes if this is something new to them.
Yeah, and that's generally meditation teachers, if you read the books, they're like, start with 5 minutes and right, and do that for, or even a couple of minutes, and do that for a week, for a few weeks, and then add, you know, layer. It's just the same thing like if you were going out to do a run, like, you don't run 5 miles. It's just, right, you're not going to be able to do it, or you're going to be so sore. It's like meditation is a very intense, if you haven't sat with your own thoughts and emotions, right, and just sat there without any kind of other stimulus, that can be extremely intense, right? And
yes.
Right? And uncomfortable. That's just a very strange experience for if you haven't done it. So, yeah, start with 3 minutes. And, you know, that's why I tell students 5 minutes. And then maybe after a few weeks, add a minute, maybe you're up to 7, right? And just see how you feel. See how it's working. See how you work it in your schedule. And then just gradually increase. But that's the general advice or guidance is just gradually increase. And then the next, you know, people are probably wondering too, like, what's the magic number to get, you know, should I meditate for 20 minutes? Should I meditate once a day? And there's really no magic number. The research maybe suggests 20. If you look across and see benefits, it's like maybe 20 to 30 minute session or a day seems to be enough. I mean, people don't have 2 hours, you know, and their lifestyle and their daily schedule can't meditate for an hour or 2 hours. So I think if you can get up to something where it's even 15, 20 minutes a day, but it's consistent, I think consistency probably is more important factor than, you know, I sat for an hour.
Totally. Yeah. And that's also a good point you brought up around how intense it can be to sit down with your eyes closed and be alone with yourself. And that's for any other clinicians out there or people listening with a trauma history, it's not advised to do that. Like you want to start with being really intentional and even just eyes open and doing it, being more in your body and also integrating the inner and the outer world. And there's nuance to this that for each person, depending on their relationship to being alone inside of themselves.
I agree 100%. And I think certain techniques are bring out a more emotionality or a more sensitivity, you know, they're more intense. So if faculty's listening, they want to put some kind of meditation in the classroom, to be cognizant of that certain techniques, and like you said, just starting with maybe a very simple mindfulness exercise versus something like compassion-based, where you're visualizing and you're using emotion, could be, in my experience, that's more intense for students than maybe just, okay, let's watch the breath for a minute or two and and see how that works.
Totally. Well, I know you have, you know, a lot of what you think about and have been writing about is meditation in the context of college or university students. So do you want to speak a little bit more to what led you to want to focus on this?
Yeah, sure. Their faces led me to this originally. They would come in. I'm talking about undergrads. About 5 years ago, I was teaching at a small private college in Macon, Georgia, called Wesleyan. It's a all-female, all-women's college. And
Not Wesleyan. I was confused at first. There's a Wesleyan?
There's a Wesleyan University, right, in Massachusetts or
no, it's in Connecticut. It's like down the road. That's why I was
not
confused researching you. I was like, Wesleyan,
yeah,
Georgia.
People have said that Wesleyan College, which is in Macon, about an hour outside of Atlanta. And I was teaching there. I was teaching education students. So the undergrads would come in. It was face-to-face, in-person classes. And they just looked just so stressed and so scattered and just so tired. And I said to myself, okay, I've got to teach them content, right? I've got to get them engaged. But I just felt like you can't just jump into that. I felt like there has to be a step before that, like a prep. There's got to be something that can prep them or pivot them, because this is not going to work. And there's other things you can do. You know, I'm sure there's professors that probably all kind of great ways to kind of segue a student into the classroom. But I drew on my experience. Like we had talked about, I've been meditating like 20-something years, and I had done in my doctoral research, I had worked with meditation and mindfulness in research settings. So I said, well, maybe I should have them try to meditate a little bit before class, right? Like before I start teaching. So it was kind of awkward at first. I mean, they're looking at, I brought in like a meditation bowl, you know, the sound bowl, and I had a small one, and I would be like, okay, we're gonna try this meditation, and I'm gonna ring the bowl and listen to, why don't you guys just listen to it, and then we do that. And then I kind of gradually moved to, why don't you just focus on your breath, and I taught them posture and how to sit and work on their breath. And I started to kind of explain a little bit why, a little bit of the research behind it, but it was clumsy, you know, for like when you do most things. At first it wasn't nuanced and it wasn't that streamlined, but they went along. I think they just, you know, they were just went along with me as the professor, and I noticed it started to work. I mean, so then I just started to do more formal research, and I started working with about 60 students, about 33 different classes, and I started to survey them on how they perceived it and how they thought it was working. And then other faculty started meditating with me. We would meet up on we called it like coffee and meditation. We meet up on Saturday in the student service center and we would meditate together. So they started meditating, and then they were like, oh, I want to try it in my classes. So then we expanded the research out to probably about 7-8 classrooms across campus, and we found basically the same thing. Most, you know, over 90% of the students perceived it as, you know, calming and stress reduction, and helped them pivot or segue into the class. So that's kind of what led me to on that track. I said, "Wow, there's something here," and so I started looking at some of the other research and what people were doing. And it's still relatively early stages of these interventions in colleges, but there's something there. It seems to help, right? You know, it seems just something as simple as a mindfulness-based meditation seems to help. So then when I looked at their faces and saw how tense they were and stressed, I didn't even realize just the severity of it. It's really, to me, like a quiet epidemic of stress in college. I mean, I was sharing that with you. The stress rates, anxiety rates are historically high levels. They're unparalleled with college students. We've never seen college students, at least the way they're reporting out, this stressed, this depressed, having these kind of mental challenges as a population. So I think that's why meditation-based interventions have become more popular and they're being implemented, is because we have to think outside the box. We have to look for ways to help students, because we know stress is not only going to affect you mentally and physically, but as a college student, the research shows you, you know, the GPA goes down, they have trouble studying, paying attention in class, they have trouble doing their homework. It's a big enemy of learning. So we've got to find creative ways or tools or new strategies. To me, teaching is not enough. I think you have to have, I guess we could call it social-emotional learning strategies. We have to have other techniques as faculty in our toolbox, because if these students are completely stressed out of their mind, I don't care how good of a teacher you are, you've got to still create the right environment, and you still have to try to get them in the right headspace. Not saying you're a counselor, right, or a psychologist, but as a teacher, you need tools that help get them psychologically in the right place, you know, at least something to teach them to help reduce the stress.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, the dynamics are the same in session with clients, where in most sessions at the start, I will invite a client and I to step into even a 30-second or a minute or 2-minute space of awareness and mindfulness, or whatever words you want to put on it, just because there's so much momentum of the day, whether it's showing up to your therapy session or showing up to your college class, where your mind is just sort of going and whatever, on the momentum of whatever has just been happening. And even taking 30 seconds or a minute to pause and reset and be aware of what's happening makes the next hour, the next session, or the next class so much more rich and focused and useful.
Right. Yeah, it's an investment, right? An investment. We can get into that too. You know, because faculty right away, if they're going to have a resistance, it's, I don't have time. I have so much content, I can't even fit in the amount of information I have to teach this semester. And you're telling me to take 3 minutes, 5 minutes, I can't afford 1 minute, right? But you're investing the time. The other factor, or the other element that I'd like to bring up is just the It's the philosophical aspect of it when you look at education and what is the definition of education. So of preparing college students for the marketplace and for their jobs and to make a salary is one aspect, right? And to teach them the academic skills. But this is my belief. My belief is it's like two wings of a bird. And one wing is the academics, but the other wing is the whole person education. It's the development or the unfoldment of potential. And so within that wing, you're looking at, well, how do I teach them maybe to increase awareness, to increase mindfulness, to work on things like emotional intelligence? So if those things are, if you value those things as a as an educator as well, then meditation is a, it's a contemplative tool. It's another tool or method that you're trying to hit that whole person education. It's not the only thing you can do, right? It's not the only tool. I never like preach it as like a panacea. I don't think it's a silver bullet, so to speak. I think it's just another tool in the contemplative toolbox. You know, it's another strategy for whole person, if you want to call it that, or holistic. Some people use the term holistic education. When Dr. Miles Neal was on, on your show earlier, he had talked about we don't get an operation manual for the mind, how to use the mind or the brain. And so if a student goes through 4 years of college and never practices mindfulness or meditation or, you know, takes psychology class, something like that, they're not studying how to use the brain. They're only studying how to retain and take in information, but they're not practicing how to kind of expand the container or how to use the computer, so to speak. So I think philosophically too, if faculty want to say, how do I address the whole person and their potential, then I think meditation makes sense.
Yeah, it's so true. It's almost like, I don't know if it's a cliche at this point, at least in my friend group, it's come up so many times where we think back on our time in school. We were in school for so long and we learned all these things about history and math and read books that we didn't really even want to read. But we never learned how to breathe properly or to understand your emotions. And people will make the argument that's meant for home life and your parents, and there should be some, but I feel like it should be both, right? I mean, if we're going to spend all this time in school, that other wing is just so important.
Yeah, I agree. I think it can come from home and as well, but if the, let's say the family or the parents haven't learned it or they have any opportunity to study these kind of meditation, mindfulness methods, then they're not going to be able to share it or teach it. So I think it's part of a complete education, right? It's just part of a complete education where, yeah, think about it. If you haven't learned emotional intelligence or even stress management within the body, mind-body system, you could go out and have the greatest career. Like, you could be prepared for your career and you could be so motivated and go out, but then all of a sudden, if you can't self-manage, right, and manage your own stress and your own energy, how far are you going to get? You think about that. When is that's going to catch up with you? No matter how great you are at your job or your career or how much money you make. I mean, I think to me it's like an essential skill, that skill of just managing your consciousness and your energy.
If teachers or faculty are listening to this right now and would like to begin the journey of integrating this or learning more, what would you suggest? What are some ideas?
Sure. I've tried to compile it. I've got a publication. I think it's going to probably not be out for a couple months, but I've tried to compile it into a 5-step process. So I've taken all the literature, I've taken my research, all the experience, and say, okay, if faculty was going to put meditation in, what's the 5 steps, right? And we could talk through a little bit of it, but step number one, the general consensus of meditation teachers and faculty in academics that use meditation is that you should first establish your own practice. Because think about it. Meditation is such a, you know, it's such a personal experience and a first person experience that before you go and you try to have students experience meditation, you want to be grounded in that, in something, right? And you want to speak from experience when you're answering their questions. We did talk a little bit if they did have, you know, an adverse effect or they started to feel uncomfortable or trauma came up. I mean, you have to really be versed in some meditation techniques. You have to do them yourself and you have to have a regular practice, and that also creates authenticity. I mean, you're going to teach something, you know, shouldn't you do it? You should kind of practice what you preach and teach what you, you know, you want to live it a bit. So that could be very simple. You could just start a morning meditation where maybe you do a mindfulness or a mantra meditation, you know, in the morning when you get up before you go to the university, the college. It could be something simple like that. You start and then maybe do that, you know, I don't know, the summer before you're going to teach in the fall, and you do that for a couple months, and you get grounded under that. Probably best to join a meditation group or get a teacher, you know, if you can get under a meditation teacher and learn from them. You're going to learn the kind of, you're going to learn a little bit about how they instruct and the kind of questions that come up and experiences, right? And then that would probably be step one. Another big one I would say is, when you position the meditation or frame it, to do it as an invitation. I think a big mistake would be to force your students to meditate before class. Number one, they didn't sign, unless it's like a mindfulness related course or something, I've taught those, but unless, if it's like biology 101, they didn't sign up to meditate. And you have to remember that. You're bringing in your pedagogy, your style, but they didn't sign on. They didn't know that was coming, maybe, until they saw the syllabus, if you put it in there. So you can frame it as an invitation of this is going to be a space of quiet reflection. We're going to take a few minutes to just reset or, right, to gather our thoughts. And during that time, I'm gonna share a meditation technique. You know, this is what meditation is. It's a form of mental training, or this is what mindfulness is. It's being, you know, in the present-centered awareness in the moment. I'm going to share a technique. If you'd like to join me when I do that, I'm going to do that and guide you through. If not, you could suggest some alternatives. You know, some faculty will have them. They can listen quietly to AirPods. You know, maybe some music that calms them. Some will draw a doodle. Some will journal. I think the idea is, if it's something quiet and doesn't disturb the meditation, then what's the diff, right? That's their time mm-hmm. to do quiet reflection. So then you're avoiding a lot of problems like resistance to it, or you're forcing me. You could have a student for religious reasons. They're bowing out, they're abstaining, and that's perfectly their choice. That's fine. So they could do something else during that time that suits their spiritual practice. So that would be that would be another piece of advice, is invite them to the practice.
Mm. Yeah, totally. Yeah, again, it overlaps so much working with clients in therapy, because the form of therapy they do, ACT, is it's super important to do the work yourself, because your psychological flexibility, as we call it, is an important part of what's going to mix in with the client's psychological flexibility. There's nothing worse than trying to tell, I remember just flashbacks early on trying to talk to a client about being present while you're completely lost in your thoughts, right, and distracted. And is there any worse, like, inner hypocrisy than that?
Right. Did you ever hear that story of, there's a story of Gandhi, when the mother brought the child to Gandhi, and I don't know if it was either salt or sugar, I've seen different versions, and said, my child is eating too much sugar. And then Gandhi said to come back in whatever it was, like 6 weeks or 6 months. And the mother didn't understand why, but then she came back. And he abstained from eating any sugar, or if it was salt, any salt, during that period of time. And then he gave advice to the child. Then he spoke to the child, because he said it had to come from a place of authenticity. I have to do it first before it's, you know, before my words are pure. And, you know, and I know that gets a bit spiritual, but I do think whatever you teach, if it's not coming from the heart, it's not coming from something you practice, I think my students wouldn't have been able to pick up on that. This guy doesn't meditate. Totally. He's completely, you know, tense or stressed out or whatever it is.
Totally. Yeah. And even if you're, because I don't think any of us are going to completely be, are going to be complete at some end destination of these things, but at least being honest about it being a shared predicament, like, it's hard as a human being present. Let's notice what that's like for us both right now, right? You know, so it's not this me on a pedestal against don't know these things. Yeah.
And probably if I could share one more tip, would be, you have to make it relevant. You have to think they're college age students, they're emerging adults. So you gotta connect it to them, and you have to make it relevant. Some of the research shows that there's some barriers particular or specific to college students, and they think it's too difficult. They think it's too hard. They're going to think, well, I can't stop my thoughts. They're going to have the misconception that they have no thoughts, or that I'm not practicing it right. they might think it's too boring too, right? They don't see the benefit. So you have to, you know, you can weave in stories, you can weave in examples, you can share things, have other students that have benefited from it. They could talk to students, but it could be something as simple as like share a study that maybe showed that helped them retain some knowledge or content. It helped students study a little bit better for an exam. Stress reduction, you can give examples of, you know, of it helps some students with stress reduction, because they're going to say, well, what's in it for me, right? What, why am I going to do this? So you have to kind of frame it, use anecdotes. I think you can use your own life at times too. They might relate to that, they might not. They might say, well, you're older, or to me, you're a male, so that's different. They might. So, you know, you could have a student that you had the previous year come in and say, I learned meditation, I've been doing it, and this is what it's done for me. And then they might go, oh, a peer, you know, a peer says it works. So that could be a strategy, you know, make it relevant.
Mm. Yeah, there are some more innovative ways people can integrate this into the classroom too, right? Like even using technology. You want to speak a little bit about that?
Yeah, we can talk about, there's a couple studies that we've designed. We're in the process of just getting ready to launch. And one of them is using Muse. And what Muse is essentially an EEG brain sensor. It's a meditation device that has about 7 brain sensors on it, and you put it on. And so it guides you, you know, you use your phone, use an app, and it guides you through a meditation. But what's different about it is it gives you real-time feedback. So you might be meditating, and there was one I did where you're listening to rain. There's like a storm. And it calibrates your brain wave. So when you're approaching, it doesn't tell you exactly, it uses what they call a calm state, which we generally think is about mostly alpha state. It doesn't give you the recipe or formula they use, but it's essentially an alpha state. And so when you're getting to that, the rain will slow. And you'll hear the raindrops start to right, lessen, and or the wind will die down or whatever. And when you're getting more distracted and your mind is busier in a beta state, right? Yeah, you'll hear the rain kind of increase. That's like one of them. But it'll use that audio real-time feedback. So what we're doing is looking at undergrads using these during an intervention and sitting and maybe 10 minutes a week, 15 minutes a week, listening to that. And we're going to look at how that affects the perceived stress levels and looks at their maybe increases or not their mindfulness and mindful attention. So because I think what's the novelty or the benefit of that is generally if you're sitting there and doing a college-based intervention, you're using a very traditional meditation where they're sitting there, right, just kind of watching the breath. They're usually using a mindfulness-based meditation. And that might work, but that might be hard for this generation, right? Those are ancient methods and techniques, but if you say, hey, put this headband on, you can use your cell phone, you're going to listen, you know, that we're thinking that maybe that might help, and the feedback might help. So that's one. There's another one that we're seeking some funding, some grant funding for, would be virtual-based reality meditation. Virtual-based reality meditation is where, right, it'll immerse you in like a 3D setting where you're in a bamboo forest, and you're just completely immersed, right? And you're doing a guided meditation, or you're floating down a stream. And there's just some there's only a few studies been done with some college students, but they're saying it has some promising results where maybe the student feels they're more immersed, but they also feel like less embarrassed because they're all using these headsets or they're all often using technology. I mean, you have to think of the embarrassment effect too of students sitting there. Sometimes they didn't want to sit there in meditation, you know, but I think if they're using a technology, maybe they'll be more apt to try it. So I think that's the way, that's definitely an avenue that researchers would want to think about is technology-assisted meditation and where that leads us with college students.
Yeah, the one with the rain and the feedback's pretty interesting. It's almost what it's like just when I meditate without that, because you can almost pay attention to your own mind and it gives you that feedback in the same way.
Right.
It's not rain, but you can almost hear and sense your mind getting busier and almost hear it die down. And it's cool. It's like a way to maybe more clearly, it's like a first step into being able to do that without something.
Right, right. And what it does, it gives you a baseline of like, if let's call it a calm state or a focus, like a mindfulness state. Like it gives you a baseline. If you've never had that experience and you don't have a teacher kind of guiding you and stuff, that's like, you don't know, right? But it actually tells you like what percent you've been in that calm state. So it starts to give you like an experience of like, oh, okay, this is what it means to be calm and focused. And then you can work off of that. So maybe for more experienced meditators, it's some of us have found it. It's a little, you know, maybe it's not as helpful. But I think if you've never meditated or a novice meditator, it might be very helpful. I think Fatty's resistance, I think one of the oppositions will be the headsets cost about anywhere from $250 to $300 a piece. So, you know, you have to think logistically. You would need like a whole set for your class. So you have you only had 20, 30 students, a small class. They would all need like a headset to practice. I think that's going to be the challenge, you know, even if we find positive results. Like, well, I don't have, you know, all these Muse headbands laying around my classroom.
Yeah. No, that's super interesting. Yeah, and then I guess the nuance, at least clinically, which we don't have to spend time on, but maybe for listeners, is finding a way to honor that there is value in being calmer and your mind being more focused, but not having that be some type of covert emotional avoidance agenda where you're can't tolerate things shifting in your experience. That's like a deeper part of meditation, right?
Sure.
It's just maybe what you're talking about is like a functional form to help students in a class, and then the more deeper state is learning how to open up and allow whatever shifts in in our experience are happening without getting so aversive or clinging on to certain
states.
Yeah, they
call it spiritual bypassing, right? Where you don't want to engage in that. Yeah, I think there's tiers. I think one way to look at it is maybe there's like tiers. So maybe you're just learning meditation, say using the Muse, just because you just want to be as distracted, right? When you go to class or something. And that's like, I just want to be a little less distracted, and that's step one. Yeah. And then as you progress through tiers, because I don't think everybody is looking to do deep meditation and spiritual awakening and I don't know if that's everyone's goal, right? Or everyone has the time or the means. And it's like, I think it's okay to have tears. You know what I mean? It's like, is, I just want to be a little less stressed, and that's my goal for meditation, right? Or I just want to be more focused, or I want to be more productive. And then you build, and then there are people that want to go full blown. You know, I want to be off the charts, you know, with my brain waves. And like, that's my goal in life. And I think it's okay to have tears. I don't think we should expect everyone to be master meditators. And still, you know, you can still derive benefit.
Yeah, and this is where context matters. Right. And maybe the function of meditation in a college classroom is different than the function of mindfulness and awareness building clinically.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Yeah. All right. Well, while we're wrapping down here, any final things, or do you want to share a little bit about people can connect with you or learn more about your work?
They can find me. My website, steveheberlin.com. They can find me through there. You can find me through a search with University of Central Florida. You can find my email. Find me through there. Email is steve.haberlin@ucf.edu. I'd be happy to collaborate or just talk meditation and collaborate and see what you're doing, answer questions, whatever they want to do. The book is, again, Meditation in the College Classrooms by Roman and Littlefield. That's everywhere. You can look on their website or Amazon. But it's essentially just a guidebook. But I think if you've never done it before, it'll help you, like, where do I start? But there are people that have been doing meditation in the classroom maybe a little bit, and they want to get deeper into either the philosophy, or like they want more techniques, or they want to nuance it more, then I think it can also serve them as that type of roadmap.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. It was great talking
great.
To you.
Great. Same. Thank you so much. It's got me out of my mind. It's got me seeing trees breathe. It's got me learning how heaven and hell are both inside of me. It's got me feeling the love that I bottled so deep when the entire world kept feeding all my greed. I'll
never know. But I can close my eyes, take a deep breath, and try to open my soul.